Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, the largest collection of Frank Lloyd Wright buildings in one location is at Florida Southern College in Lakeland.
He had never received the opportunity to work within the state of Florida yet, and he had also never been given the opportunity to design even a single college building, let alone an entire college campus plan. So how could he say no to a prospect like that?
We'll discuss how Walt Disney World affected the construction of our state capitol building.
These seemingly disparate endeavors dovetailed in myriad ways for nearly two decades, particularly in their employment of symbolic architecture.
And we'll talk about Smith's Bakery in Pensacola. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
At Florida Southern College in Lakeland, one feels the influence of the great American architect, Frank Lloyd Wright, who designed many of its buildings. The college was planned to be in harmony with the Florida landscape and climate, and it's fitting that Florida Southern offers an outstanding course in architecture. Students may attain Bachelor of Science degrees in business, architecture, and the liberal arts.
Frank Lloyd Wright is known as one of the most influential architects of the 20th century. His largest single collection of buildings in one location is at Florida Southern College in Lakeland. Frank Lloyd Wright wanted to create a uniquely American style of architecture that broke away from European models and create geometrically interesting organic structures that blended into the natural landscape. Jack Coffey is manager of tours and educational programs at the Frank Lloyd Wright Visitor Center at Florida Southern College.
Wright perceived most buildings of his era as requiring the landscape to be cleared and flattened, you know, for ease of construction. He also felt that buildings of his time were extremely boxy, formal, and kind of obsessed with old traditional European, usually, aesthetics. So Wright wanted to create a new type of architecture, organic architecture, that honored the landscape, that was designed into and around pre-existing natural features, that was designed to highlight and bring those worthy natural elements beyond into the house. He also strove to create a much more free-flowing and ambitious geometric language, breaking the box, as he would say, creating much more informal, comfortable living and working environments.
Arden Mitchell is director of admissions at Florida Southern.
It really makes Florida Southern College a unique space to be a part of such rich history and be a part of something that was designed specifically for our college campus and for all the students that would have walked the hallways in the past and will walk the hallways in the future.
What would become Florida Southern College was established in 1883. The college moved to its current location in Lakeland in 1922. In 1938, all of the buildings on campus were red brick Jeffersonian and Georgian Revival style architecture. College President Dr. Lud Spivey had a new vision for the Florida Southern College campus.
At the time, Florida Southern, like so many other small private colleges, was really struggling because of the Great Depression. The onset of the Great Depression had decimated our little school's finances and enrollment. And Dr. Spivey, president at the time, president since 1925, had been working tirelessly to keep the doors open. He had a vision, though. He believed that if he could find something big and bold that he could do with his little college, that it would get the school back on the map and truly back on its feet. Dr. Spivey saw photos of Wright's recently completed Falling Water in multiple publications in 1937, going into 38. He did a bit of research, and he believed that Wright would, if Wright were to design for the campus, he would produce something unlike anything the world had seen before in terms of higher education.
With the concept of a modern, perhaps even futuristic college campus in mind, Dr. Spivey made the bold move of contacting Frank Lloyd Wright directly with a short but impactful message.
He sent a telegram off to Frank Lloyd Wright in early April 1938. The telegram reads, "Mr. Wright, desire a conference with you to discuss the construction of a great education temple in Lakeland, Florida. Please collect wire when and where I can see you." Wright responds, "Come meet with me April 28th at Taliesin for your conference." Taliesin being his Wisconsin estate and studio. Spivey makes it up, sits down with Wright, and Wright took the job on after just that single meeting. He had never received the opportunity to work within the state of Florida yet, and he had also never been given the opportunity to design even a single college building, let alone an entire college campus plan. So how could he say no to a prospect like that? He first set foot on the grounds May 8th, 1938, and from that point on, he would work on this project for over 20 years.
The centerpiece of Wright's design for the Florida Southern College campus is the Annie Pfeiffer Chapel. Soaring to 65 feet, it's the tallest building on campus.
With Florida Southern being a Methodist-affiliated institution, Wright wanted to create a building that would be a vertical centerpiece. And what better building to use for that than the church? Wright felt that was the spiritual core, the beating heart of the institution. So that's why it is so tall. The signature tower that dominates its roof is meant to be a defining landmark for the campus as a whole. The tower is very unique. It's completely hollow, running east to west, and formed by these interesting, almost origami-like shapes on either side, and crowned with intricate metalwork at the top. The design may be curious to a lot of people until they step foot inside the building, where they'll find that the ceiling is filled with skylights that look directly up through that central landmark tower to the natural sky above. It's all meant to turn the sky itself into a sort of work of art that defines the chapel's ceiling within. The interior of the Annie Pfeiffer Chapel soars upward and is filled with glass pieces in the concrete block walls, colored glass pieces in a variety of different colors, over 50,000 in total.
Arden Mitchell is director of admissions at Florida Southern College, and her grandmother, Barbara Jeanette Florence Mosley, helped to build the original library on campus during World War II. Mitchell's entire family has a long history with the college.
My great-grandfather and great-grandmother were students of Florida Southern. They had seven children. My grandfather was the youngest of seven. All seven attended Florida Southern as students. My grandfather graduated in 1940. My grandmother graduated in 1948, and she would share stories of conversations with President Spivey about her being a student at the college and considerations about being able to afford being at Florida Southern. And President Spivey assured that they'd be able to work with her so that she could be a student at the college. And she would share stories about working as a part of the old library as a part of her time as a student.
Dr. Spivey had allowed students to work for tuition on our various Wright design buildings. All of Wright's buildings to some degree had student involvement as a result, but the first five built during the Great Depression era were built, and World War II, were built entirely by student hands. So when the war broke out, most of our enrollment, the vast majority of our enrollment, was female at the college. And so the ladies got together and got to work on building the library. It's the only building on the entire campus that was built pretty much entirely by women.
To know that she has involvement in what's become such an important part of Florida Southern College and the campus and the history. My middle name is Mosley, which is my grandmother's maiden name, so I feel a special connection to her carrying her name on as a part of my own. She was very involved in the church, studied Christian education as a student at Florida Southern. My family has a long history of serving as pastors in the United Methodist Church, and there have been times where women weren't able to serve in those roles, but she was very much an advocate and a feminist and empowering for women and their involvement.
Frank Lloyd Wright was inspired by American transcendentalists Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau, whose core philosophical beliefs included a respect for nature. Wright was also influenced by Native American and Mesoamerican design. His buildings at Florida Southern College reflect these aesthetics and are linked by a unique covered walkway called the Esplanade.
The Esplanade is an immensely important feature of the campus. Wright himself even identified it in an early letter describing the forming campus concept in his head. He even told Dr. Spivey that it was the most important feature of the campus. From a functional standpoint, it's a wonderful feature for the climate. It connects almost all of Wright's buildings together. It reaches over a mile in total length as his longest covered walkway system in his career. So you can go from building to building of his design and be perfectly sheltered from the sun, from the rain, and of course it's going to generate a nice breeze, helping to keep people cool on those hot Florida days. Beyond that, though, it is also much in the same way that Annie Pfeiffer's tower is a vertical landmark for the campus, the Esplanade is meant to be a horizontal unifying element. It doesn't just connect to the buildings, it often seamlessly merges with the facades of the buildings themselves. Wright wanted the buildings to feel as though they were parts of a whole, and the Esplanade is largely how he achieves this. The Esplanade really is there to make the buildings feel as though they're all working together towards a greater purpose, that they're all parts of a whole.
Frank Lloyd Wright began his work at Florida Southern College in 1938, the year after he completed his most famous house, Falling Water, in Mill Run, Pennsylvania. 20 years later, after Wright's last structure was built at Florida Southern, he completed the design and construction of his most famous public building, the Guggenheim Museum in New York City. 12 of the 18 structures that Wright designed for the Florida Southern College campus were built, including the intimate Danforth Chapel, a large water dome, and Wright's only constructed planetarium. Part of Frank Lloyd Wright's grand design for Florida Southern College included an adjacent neighborhood of what he called Usonian houses. As Jack Coffey explains, in 2013, one of those homes was finally built as a museum.
There were going to be about 20 homes of Wright's design built on the far eastern border of the school's grounds for professors to live in, which would have really cemented this notion of the campus being a community in and of itself. You're living here, you're working here, your family lives here, and the students are also living nearby in the residence halls as well. The reason it wasn't built back in the day is very simple reason, same with the other five buildings, funding. Dr. Spivey tried for about 8 years and couldn't get any funding for it. But in 2013, it was fully built as Wright intended, and opened as part of the new Sharp Family Tourism and Education Center.
The Frank Lloyd Wright Visitor Center at Florida Southern College is open daily from 9:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, Tallahassee was originally selected as our state capital because it was halfway between St. Augustine and Pensacola. As people populated the rest of the state, it's been proposed more than once that a more central location, like Orlando, would be more appropriate.
It might seem strange to associate the mid-20th century construction of a new Florida State Capitol building with the creation of Disney World, but Derek R. Everett makes a compelling argument for their relationship in his 2017 article, The Mouse and the State House. The close timing of the announcement of the launch of both, the interesting relationship of architectural decisions, the words of politicians connecting the construction in Tallahassee and Orlando support Everett's thesis that, quote, these seemingly disparate endeavors dovetailed in myriad ways for nearly two decades, particularly in their employment of symbolic architecture, end quote. Florida's three-story state house was constructed in the 1840s on the city's highest hill. Its location and neoclassical design with column pediment conveyed the values of reason, law, and legitimate government power, a visual assurance of the stability of the state. As the state grew and the demands of government expanded, the Capitol building was also enlarged in 1900s, in 1920s, and in 1947. A cupola was added and then replaced by a silver dome. By the 1960s, the state house had become less architectural evidence of power and law and more a collection of additions that failed to meet the needs of a modern state. In 1965, Governor W. Hayden Burns established the Capitol Center Planning Committee, CCPC, to review proposals for renovating or replacing the state house. The committee toured other states to assess their capitals and were particularly impressed by North Carolina's modern state house, designed by the internationally renowned architect Edward Durell Stone. They described the North Carolina building as modern, efficient, optimistic, confident, an example of the progressive thinking and modernity of what was viewed as the new Florida.
But Connie, there were many other opinions about what the new Capitol building should look like, right?
Yes. Following initial enthusiastic momentum for constructing a new Capitol rather than renovating the old building, the process quickly devolved into squabbling over potential revenue sources to finance construction, building aesthetics, allocations of space, and public input. A more fundamental problem arose in 1967 when Senator Lee Weisenborn lobbied to move the Capitol from Tallahassee to Orlando. The question of relocation played out in the legislature and the courts throughout 1967 and 1968 before agreement emerged on Tallahassee as, quote, an inconvenient but familiar and tolerable status quo, end quote. In the course of rejecting Orlando as a new site for the state capitol, Disney obtained approval for the now infamous Reedy Creek Improvement District, and South Florida received additional funding for higher education. After interviewing 28 architectural firms, the CCPC narrowed the field to two, Edward Durell Stone's New York City-based office and the Jacksonville engineering firm Reynolds Smith & Hills, RS&H. To the relief of a divided committee, the two firms agreed to work together, with Stone providing the design and RS&H ensuring its functionality. The project now moved to the approval of a four-stage plan that included the construction of two square office buildings flanking the existing Capitol, a 20-story executive office tower, and a large boxy building with a central domed rotunda. The initial plan called for the demolition of the old Capitol building and the creation of a plaza area. Upon seeing the plans, Malcolm Johnson, editor of the Tallahassee Democrat, proclaimed the project, quote, an ingenious blend of the past and future Florida, the nostalgic and the visionary, that looks backward to our heritage as well as forward to our future, end quote. Keeping in mind Florida's role in the space race, Everett interpreted Stone's design as it incorporated, quote, a sleek modern skyscraper to accommodate a growing bureaucracy, a reflection of the state's cutting-edge reputation, the jumping-off point into humanity's next frontier, end quote. Not everyone saw it that way, particularly the state comptroller Fred O. Dickinson. He championed the restoration of the old state house as part of the plan and, quote, feared that a skyscraper would overshadow nearby buildings, end quote. He also fretted about the lack of classical elements, especially the lack of a real dome, which real state capitals should have. Some legislators thought the plan was too elaborate, and claimed it to be a, quote, princely and ponderous palace for potentates, end quote. Governor Kirk thought the money could be better spent on highways.
And Connie, those hoping to preserve the historic Capitol building were obviously successful in their efforts, even with construction of the new building.
Yes, in 1970, Kirk lost his re-election campaign to Reuben Askew, who forged ahead with the Stone and RS&H plan. Still, the traditionalists continued their fight with the modernists. Dickinson evoked Disney once more to point out that the theme park's replicas of Williamsburg and colonial America as evidence of the importance of the past architectural styles in the most modern of tourist venues, a claim one sociologist dismissed as simply an example of the Disneyization of America. The St. Petersburg Times noted that Disney also had a pioneer land with log cabins and questioned whether Florida's capital should be constructed of, quote, hewn logs and mud caulking, end quote. As the battle raged on, Rabbi Stanley Garfine offered up a prayer on the opening day of the legislative session that, in part, said, "In our desire to build a capital, keep us from the idolatry of worshiping a particular shape, material, or style," end quote. Finally, in 1972, Dickinson and most of the cabinet acquiesced to the tower plan, and in December, work began. Construction lasted 5 years, and the Capitol was dedicated on March 31, 1978. The final controversy centered on what to do with the old Capitol building. A surprising number of Floridians, especially schoolchildren, rallied around retention and restoration of the building. Secretary of State Bruce Smathers refused to vacate his office in the old Capitol and hosted a Save the Old Capitol party at the site. In the end, $7 million was found for renovation, and in 1982, it was dedicated as the Florida Historic Capitol Museum. As Everett concludes, Florida politicians, quote, waged a passionate battle over how to reflect their amorphous, vigorous state through political architecture, balancing practical and symbolic needs in their emblematic building, a physical expression of a diverse community of yesterday, today, and tomorrow, end quote, that owed some debt to the mouse.
And of course, constructing a big new Capitol building in Tallahassee ensured that state government would remain in Tallahassee and not move to Orlando. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. The smell of baking bread no longer wafts from Smith's Bakery in Pensacola, but as Holly Baker reports, efforts are underway to preserve the historic building.
The Florida Trust for Historic Preservation's annual 11 to Save list brings attention to the most threatened historic properties and resources across Florida. The Florida Trust has identified Smith's Bakery in Pensacola as one of the most endangered historic properties in the state. It's been included on their annual 11 to Save list. Ennis Davis is an urban planning consultant and a trustee for the Florida Trust for Historic Preservation. He told me more about Smith's Bakery.
Founded by Gordon Smith in 1899 in Mobile, Alabama, Smith's Bakery grew from a four-baker operation into a major company employing more than 600 people who produce baked goods throughout the entire Gulf region. In 1928, the operation opened a new industrial bakery in Pensacola's Belmont DeVillers neighborhood. This neighborhood was the historic center of Black commerce and culture in Pensacola, and is actually one of two locations in the state of Florida that have been designated as stops on the Mississippi Blues Trail. With buildings dating back as far as 1918, is situated in the heart of this neighborhood. This large industrial bakery served as the neighborhood's economic epicenter for more than 65 years, and it once employed over 100 workers that produced Sunbeam English muffins and rolls.
For almost seven decades, the smell of baking bread at Smith's Bakery wafted through the Belmont DeVillers neighborhood. Smith's Bakery was one of the first in the country to use an automatic dough mixer and a bread slicing machine. The bakery was known not only for their delicious rolls, but also for their donuts and cakes. When the bakery closed in 1990, the 40 remaining employees lost their jobs, and the building was abandoned. In recent years, Reverend John Powell, the founder of the nonprofit group Truth for Youth that serves underprivileged, low-income, and at-risk youth, has led efforts to preserve and revitalize Smith's Bakery.
Smith's Bakery closed its doors in 1990 because at that point, the facility was considered to be dated and obsolete for modern-day baking needs. Over the next three decades, the bakery's number of industrial buildings have aged and continue to deteriorate over that time. A local nonprofit has been diligently working to raise funds to restore the complex into what will be known as the Belmont Cultural Center. The intent of the Belmont Cultural Center will be to serve as a history and cultural center for the surrounding community. And some of the proposed spaces within this complex include an event center, auditorium, and a kitchen that will be used to host activities for youth in the surrounding area.
The nominators hope inclusion of Smith's Bakery on the 11 to Save list will increase awareness for the property's restoration efforts. Ennis Davis.
There are several reasons why the preservation of Smith's Bakery is very important. Number one, they say the greenest building is one that already exists. Smith's Bakery has been an important cultural landmark and center within this historic Pensacola community since 1918, so well over a century. And then given the building's large, significant size, it is the largest building within the Belmont DeVillers neighborhood. It offers the potential for adaptive reuse, several different types of activities that could crystallize continued revitalization. And with gentrification is kind of what we call in the planning world, where you're revitalizing the community from a community-led perspective that limits displacement and gentrification. Being a large industrial center does have the space for a variety of uses to serve as a cultural center for the community, but also a potential economic center for the community, for this current generation and future generations, while paying homage to past generations of the Belmont DeVillers community.
To learn more about the Florida Trust for Historic Preservation and their annual 11 to Save list, go to floridatrust.org. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Holly Baker, Public History Coordinator for the Florida Historical Society and Archivist at the Library of Florida History in Cocoa.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org and find us on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Holly Baker. The program is edited by John White. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.